Where There's a Will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.
You're listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life about the mental health system in Ireland. In this six-part series, we ask why our mental health system is so dysfunctional, who is responsible for making change happen, and how we can collectively respond, join the dots, and make things better for all of us. I'm Paula McLaughlin.
And I'm Ciara O'Connor. And in this series, we'll be tackling some tough issues and sharing stories about mental health which may be difficult to hear. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text help to 51444. Or if you just need to talk, you can contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP.
So we've talked about our systems, our politics, our policies and our government. And in this episode, it's time to talk about ourselves, our society and our culture. Because while the mental health system, of course, needs to be fixed, we have to look at the role we play in that. We need to ask ourselves, do we have an epidemic of mental health problems in Ireland? How are we contributing to poor mental health through stigma? Are we really putting people at the centre? And we also need to ask, how do we collectively build communities and systems that always catch people when they fall?
You can tell by the accent I'm a northerner. From about as far north as you can get, I'm a fellow town man of Liam Neeson and Ian Paisley.
Brian Higgins is the CEO of Pieta House. Pieta are one of Ireland's best-known charities who work with people experiencing mental health crises. Brian likes to tell a story about Spike Milligan. Spike had bipolar disorder, and he spoke about his mental health as being delicate, like an egg.
Spike Milligan, he speaks of it so eloquently, and he talks of giving himself to another person and handing himself and his mental health to another person. And he says, look, I'm giving you this egg, me, but please don't hold it too tight, because if you do, you'll crush it and you'll crush me. And please don't hold it too loose, because if you do, you might drop it and it breaks. But if you do that right, you can help incubate it and something new and something beautiful will grow and flourish. And I think at Pieta, that's what we try to do. People come to us in this fractured state, not broken. The shell is maybe cracked, but the egg is intact. And we see that part of our job is to hold them through that point of extreme crisis so that they themselves and the networks around them can strengthen to the point where their life is something that is in front of them again rather than behind them. But I think what we do in Pieta in our therapy rooms is it's like emptying the pocket change of your mind. And it's a bit like if you and I empty our pockets on the table, we can look through it and say, look, that's fluff, we don't need that. There's an old bus ticket, we don't need that. There's some UK coins, we do need those, but we don't need them in our pocket today. Do you need all the keys in your key ring? You know, maybe some of them are for an old padlock or for the old car and for a lock that's changed. So you can get rid of a lot of this stuff. And then you can put back what you need and get rid of what you don't need. Going back to Spike Milligan, that act of holding people, but to help them incubate what their new life is going to be. The secret of how it's done, I think, relies on the personal relationships between our clients and our staff. And that's just something very precious. I worked then 11 years in homelessness. The suicide rates among the homeless are about 35 times higher than they are among the general population. And so throughout my 11 years with DePaul here and in the United States, the numbers of people that we lost to suicide were utterly unacceptable. But the understanding of how it might happen wasn't, because it became quite evident to me that, you know, if you imagine your life as a dartboard, well, if you're the bullseye in the centre, for you and I and for people who are listening, we're probably lucky enough that there is somebody, maybe a partner, in the ring around us. And around that, we have our family. You know, as you move out, we have friends, we have work colleagues, we have maybe sports teams or hobbies, groups that we're involved in. And then we have acquaintances. So we have quite a full circle of people in varying degrees of circles around us. But if you take a homeless person who's living in the street, those circles decrease. You're not in employment, so you don't have work colleagues. The number of acquaintances you have probably disappears as time goes by. You may be distant from your family, and you may not have a partner. So I think it became quite stark for me that I could understand, not accept, but understand how somebody could look at themselves in the mirror one morning and say, there's nobody else for you, and I'm not sure I can hold you any longer. Mm. And I can see where that stark decision becomes a reality.
And those rings of support diminish so quickly for people experiencing a mental health crisis. We all have those rings of support around us. You, me, our bosses, our neighbours, our clubmates, our friends. And sometimes we can even forget that we are rings in so many other people's dartboards too.
Leon Guilfoyle is my name. I'm 39 years old. Jesus. I'm a Dublin man, obviously. This accent wasn't licked up off the ground. I'm an ex-musician, still a musician. I was a touring musician for years, and then now I'm trying to earn actual money.
Leon has had mental health issues for as long as he can remember.
He had a really tough childhood and a lot of problems at home.
And I can't help but feel so sorry for this kid, because if anyone had actually recognised what was going on for him, or if he'd been given the help that he deserved by the system, if he had had those strong rings of support on his dartboard, it could have helped go so far to prevent some of the pain that's been with him for his whole life. We met on a sunny day in the Garden of Remembrance, and we had a chat about his mental health journey.
When I was pretty young, when I was about 13 or 14, was when I started to think that I noticed that I was a bit different. But then I started to get symptoms that I couldn't control. You know, I used to get depressed and I used to get suicidal, and I attempted suicide a few times. But look, I thought that this was just weird rocker things. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I thought it was. I was an emo before emo was a thing, you know what I mean? So I just thought that this was part of growing up. I was made homeless when I was 16 for 6 months, lived under a bridge. You know, but when I first started to recognise it was when I was about 13, 14, sort of when I became self-aware-ish. But I thought it was just me, you know. I didn't know what mental health was. There was no real discussion about it back then. So I'd had nowhere to stay, so I had to sleep under Ashtown Railway Bridge. Now, it sounds worse than it was. It was comfortable. We had a couch in there. And me and a bunch of friends, they didn't live there now. They just used to drink there and smoke there and stuff. But that was the introduction to drugs. And that was a slippy slope. Thankfully, I was lucky. I managed to dodge major addiction. I did get hooked on alcohol. I was drinking every day, like hardcore. As soon as I woke up, going out and getting booze and then drinking until you fell asleep. Now, we had plywood walls and a couch and lit posters on the walls and stuff and candles and stuff. Like, so it wasn't... There'd be a lot of homeless people in Dublin City who'd actually love this. It was... You know, actually, in this climate, there's probably apartments being rented out for fucking 800 quid that were equivalent, you know? I remember the day that I was kicked out of the house very, very clearly, like it was yesterday. And I have real problems with my short-term memory, so it's burned in there. So that day stood in my memory because I'd come home from the FCA. I was in the FCA, and I was wearing the FCA uniform. But it was horrible, like woolly green jumper, and oh my God, it was horrible. But that was one of my clothes for like a month.
At least it was warm.
It was warm as hell. It was the summertime.
It wasn't long after this period of homelessness that Leon started to realise he needed help for his mental health, and we'll hear shortly about what happened when he went to the doctor. One of the things that has started to come into clear focus is that we individualise mental health journeys far too much. So much of the narrative in mental health is about that one person who maybe grew up in a tough house, who has problems, problems that only happen to people like them. But that attitude is toxic because it's not an individual issue. Our society, our environment, contributes so much to our mental health. So in order to take the conversation to the next level,
we need to look closely at ourselves in the mirror and ask what we can and should be doing better. And we also need to clearly state that society has a responsibility for many of our mental health problems. As CEO of Pieta, Brian is one of Ireland's foremost mental health leaders, but he doesn't see it as clear-cut as that.
I have a very uncomfortable relationship with leadership. I might be asked to speak at something and say, oh yeah, we're looking for leaders across. Now, whether I'm a leader or not doesn't come with the title of CEO of Pieta House. Leadership is about, can you influence people to come in the direction you want them to come in? So you can be elected Taoiseach tomorrow. It doesn't mean you're a leader. It means you're the Taoiseach. So I think leadership is something that we confuse with a title rather than an ability.
Leadership is certainly missing from our mental health system, but Brian is right. We don't need to look just to our politicians to be our leaders. Each and every one of us can be leaders in our own homes, families and communities to make society better, more human, more accepting, and create a society that catches people when we fall.
I'm of an age, I can certainly remember long before there were any mobile phones and KPIs and performance management in jobs, and when life was a little bit slower, I can remember that. And I can remember it feeling good.
Shari McDade, CEO of Mental Health Reform, talks about the rapid pace of change in our society and how these changes have impacted our collective mental health, for better and for worse.
In some ways, all of these changes that we've experienced, technology and life pace and everything, have clearly brought benefits to us. We can connect to people in ways that we couldn't connect at all in the past. When I think of myself, I'm someone who experiences panic attacks. I've experienced panic attacks since I was 16 years old. And I certainly hadn't ever heard of a panic attack when I was 16. And I never knew of anyone that had such a thing. And I didn't understand that that's what I was going through until I was about 30, years and years later. It's probably more likely today that a 16-year-old will have heard of the idea of panic attacks, so that if they are experiencing those sensations, might say, oh, this sounds like that thing I've heard of. Someone's talked about a panic attack. I bet that's what I'm experiencing. Our society is a tough society to maintain our mental health. We're busy. We're pressured. For women, we're supposed to be beautiful. We're supposed to be perfect looking all the time. We're supposed to be nice. And for men, they're supposed to be calm and in control and cool and on top of things all the time, and also look great. So I think that those kinds of expectations and the pace of life and the lack of downtime and some of the disconnectedness as well, in terms of us not having maybe as much time for social life as we might have had in the past, and family pressures and everything, I do think that those things do not help to keep us well, that we have to almost fight against that tide all the time. Fight against the tide.
Dominic Layden is the CEO of Aware, a mental health charity which was established to counteract stigma and provide support for people experiencing depression.
It's an issue that's personal to me. My own brother had experience of depression, and he ultimately took his life at 22, and I had lived for 4 years in the house with depression. The model that existed back when my brother was in hospital in John O' God's St. Pat's was that, you know, the psychiatrist that would not entertain any of the views from the family. We were totally ignored. That we were told clearly that he was the only person that was capable of making a diagnosis and his treatment, and we were outside of that. And when I joined, I thought this was fantastic. There were these services that were being provided. God, if this existed back then my brother might be alive today. The world that we're living in today, the environment has changed so dramatically from when I was a child and from my grandparents. Relationships are all changing in the world. Personal relationships and workplace relationships are changing. So nobody today can say that they will join Guinness's and they'll be there till they're 70 years of age. You know, those days are gone, and getting the retirement watch. So everybody has insecurity. You can't find, and I think that starts at the age of maybe 25, 27 and 30 years of age. But then you bring it down to a younger age group and you say there's marriage breakdown, there's issues in the family that would have existed in many ways, but there were bigger families. Maybe it wasn't. Now they're aware of these issues in a way. And then there's an insecurity. And I think if we were to take the onset of technology and particularly social media at one aspect. But when I was growing up as a child, America was like another planet. And, you know, whatever, and a celebrity meant Dallas or somebody, or, you know, nowadays it's on your social media and you're watching all these people having these, I think kids are watching everybody else, particularly girls at the moment are watching, you know, they're watching other girls and they're looking at them and saying how pretty they are or what they're wearing, what their social life is. And I think that brings an enormous amount of pressure, peer pressure. It applies to boys as well. But I think there's a lot of other pressures in life today that that our environment is bringing those pressures down. And therefore, from that perspective, the question I think is, I think it's not really so much has it grown or gone up or down between 50 years ago. Are we in a crisis today? And I think the answer to that, in my view, is a firm yes. And the reason we're in a crisis, I think, is we could deal with all of these if we were teaching our kids at an early age and adults the skills to actually be able to deal with life challenges. Then we could say to ourselves, well, the environment has changed, but at least we're doing something about it.
We asked Brian Higgins if he felt there was an epidemic of anxiety and depression in Ireland, especially among young people.
No, I don't agree that there's an epidemic in the, I suppose, in the sense of the terminology of epidemic. I think what there is an increased use of services, mm-hmm. an increased demand for services. Mm-hmm. And we need to respond to that. But I think it's come through the work of A Lust for Life, the work of Pieta House, the work of so many other organisations and individuals who are highlighting the issues of mental health. Because what we see in terms of young people is about 40% are under the age of 18, about half are under the age of 25. Now, if you view that just as stark as that, that is an epidemic. But if you view it in terms of what you and I have been striving for and what so many others have been striving for, we want people to seek help. We want people to acknowledge what their normal level of existence is and that if they dip below that and they need help, come and ask for it. I think Ireland is in a very interesting position, and where we have gone, the journey we've made in the last 5 years, never mind 10, 15, 20, that's a real seismic shift. And what I do think has happened is we have these public conversations, but it doesn't trickle to every corner of the country, and those opinions are not necessarily shared. And one of the biggest challenges we have in Pieta House is stigma, because for the last 12 years, we have existed at the point when somebody has already decided that their life is behind them, there's nothing in front, and suicide is the option that they are most seriously looking at. And within that context, our job is to try and give them reasons for living rather than reasons for dying, and to work with people who are physically engaging in self-harm and give them real physical tools for self-care. And in order to do that, what we have to do is challenge stigma. Because we know in Pieta House that people come through the door because they are black or they're not Caucasian, they're not white Irish. We know that people come through our door because they are gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender. Because there are people who come to us at the point where they are considering or even have a plan for their own death. And I think the stigmas that have driven them there are the stigmas we need to challenge. These are things that people live with and struggle with. And these are things that sadly people die with. And I think the challenge that we have in Pieta, the challenge that we have as a society, is to understand what the stigmas are.
Shari and others recognise the elephant in the room of our mental health in this country. And that's how much it intersects with absolutely everything else in our lives. Our mental health and well-being doesn't exist in a vacuum. Sure, there's a genetic component, but it is massively influenced by our environment, our housing, our jobs, our relationships, our childhood, and our socioeconomic background.
We're going to need to get to a point for young people where the lives that they're leading are less pressurized. Ultimately, we're not going to have a population with good mental health if the circumstances that surround them are not healthy. So if they're in a neighborhood that doesn't have any place where they can safely play, we won't have good mental health for people where kids have such high expectations on them or such peer pressures on them that it's very hard for them to even keep up or to keep a sense of themselves or to go at their own pace or to find their own way of living and being. And that then extends into the workplaces. So we're not really going to solve our mental health crisis if we are pressurizing people in work with very high demands and long hours and no downtime and all that. And I think employers are starting to get this to some extent. There are progressive employers who understand that actually their employees do better when they have breaks, when they have time out, when they can go at their own pace and that kind of thing. One of the best things we can do to solve the mental health crisis in this country is to solve the housing crisis, because insecure housing is not good for anyone's mental health. And it's very difficult to have a sense of being able to cope in a situation where every day you're not sure whether you're going to be able to stay in your home for an extended period of time, or if you're actually homeless and you're couch surfing, or you're literally staying in a hostel and you're not sure how long it's going to be before you get to have a place of your own. It's challenging in that situation to have a good sense of self and a sense of being able to cope. I mean, it's amazing how resilient people are in those circumstances, but we certainly could do a lot better to support people's mental health by making it easier for them to have a good, secure, affordable home.
We need to create environments that keep people well. Stigma and discrimination doesn't keep people well. Overworking doesn't keep people well. Social isolation doesn't keep people well. And as Martin Rogan from Mental Health Ireland said, if you're sitting on the M50 for hours a day because you can't afford housing near your work, that doesn't keep people well.
Genuinely, if we want to respond to this, there are some fundamentals that need to happen across how we live our lives today in terms of how our educational system works, how we value and cherish people and families, how we look at early life, how we contribute to those first 1,000 days, what's that experience like? Do you get credible supports as a parent? Are you spending many hours a day sitting in motorway traffic? Do you have a home you can afford? And you know, your general quality of life. You simply won't be able to treat your way out of this. You cannot leave people in a toxic environment and then hope to be able to do 15 minutes of mindfulness and press the reset button.
There is a disconnect between education and mental health. There's a disconnect between health, physical health, and mental health. And I think there is a real disconnect within mental health between equipping a system for a point of crisis. So having a mental health system that is based around when you are sick. If we continue to invest our time, energy and finances at the point of crisis, then we will continue to have to make that a bigger and a bigger and a bigger budget. If we can balance that and invest in proper prevention, with children, in labour wards, do we talk to parents or parents-to-be and say, here's what you might consider doing that will help your child? We need to think further about how far back to the problem start and how far back do we need to be to resolve them? And I think our energies are spent at crisis stage. We need to move much further back.
I spoke to Leon about what happened later in his life as he became an adult, when he lived with depression and developed anxiety attacks, which he describes so viscerally what they felt like that I could almost feel it in myself.
At this point, I would have took electroshock therapy. I mean, honest to God, it was that bad. It was a constant, worthlessness, constant nothingness, constant fucking mute numbness. Existence wasn't even there, you know what I mean? It was just like if you were spirit poured into a vessel and there was nothing around you. It was just emptiness. It was just fucking horrible. It was horrible. The black waves is what I used to call it. Like you're underneath the blackest ocean and you're fighting to get to the top. And then as soon as you get to the top, you still have to surf all the way to the fucking beach. You know, it was fucking horrible. So anything was good enough. 2006, I started to get... I went to Grasspop in Belgium, the festival. And on the way over, I started to get these really weird, like, palpitations. This really weird feeling that I'd never had before. And I felt like I was dying. Like, I felt like there was something fucking really wrong. I felt like I was having a heart attack. I felt like I had a brain tumour or something. Like, it was some really, really horrible, weird feeling. And it kept happening. Almost on the hour. To the point where the whole weekend of the festival, I was basically just leaving every couple of hours to go up and lie down in the tent. And the only relief from was going to sleep. So when I came back, my girlfriend was there with me, and when I came back, she said, you have to go to the doctor, because she was really worried. And I went to the doctor, and I explained everything, thinking that they were going to send me into A&E, you know, for MRIs.
He's having
and everything.
A heart attack, this poor guy, look.
And the doctor says, you're having an anxiety attack. And I was like, what the hell is that? And he said, a panic attack. And I said, oh, I've heard of a panic attack. I thought they were things that 16-year-olds did to get attention. You know? So he said, no, he said, it's a very real thing. And he said, the symptoms that you have are definitely pointing towards that. Have you any history of depression? And that's when the whole thing came to a fore. He was the first one to recognise and say, there is something wrong here. So I went to a psychiatrist and I was diagnosed then with generalised anxiety disorder, seasonal affective disorder, which is a weird one, which is definitely fucking, I feel that now. I mean, even coming into the winter, you can feel it kind of dragging a bit. Like, I'd been diagnosed by GPs. Up to that point. And it was good, they were decent diagnoses, and they put me on SSRIs and stuff for insomnia and stuff. It just, they stopped working. I couldn't take any of the sleeping pills and anxiolytics anymore. They were just doping me up. I was on like Zimivane and Halcyon and fucking Xanax and Valium. The first diagnosis I had with a psychiatrist was traumatic. I went out and I was left waiting. There was nobody there at all, just me. And I was left in the waiting room for 4 hours. And when I went in, then he decided that I was in there for 5 minutes. And he said that I was a drug addict. Because he said, do you do any drugs? And I said, no. I said, occasionally I drink. I don't really drink that much anymore. I said, I'd occasionally drink, and I might have a joint every now and again. You know, maybe once every night, one a night, to try and get a sleep. Because I don't like sleeping pills. And he said, right, that's your problem. I was so confused by the whole thing, because it was 5 minutes. I was only in the room 5 minutes after waiting for 4 hours, and it was bizarre. My mother, who was an ex-psychiatrist, she's retired, she was a psychiatric nurse in Brendan's, you know, really well respected. She said, you should sue the fucker. And I said, no, look, it's too much fucking work and trouble. So I didn't even bother reporting him, you know what I mean? As far as I know, he's probably still practicing. Now, I've had better experiences since then, but public health is a fucking nightmare. In order to get a real, proper, consistent diagnosis where someone's actually looking at you properly, you have to go private. And I can't afford to go private because it's a fucking fortune. So I've been 10 years through the system, in and out of different psychiatrists, different therapists, trying to get a label, as you said, put on it.
Leon spent years looking for help, fighting for his life, quite literally, and fighting a system that was pulling and dragging the other way. A system that didn't treat him like an equal human being. And if we zoom out further, he's fighting against society too. Fighting against a society that tells all of us that if you aren't coping, you're clearly not trying hard enough.
There's a lot of undiagnosed and misdiagnosed people out there, because it wasn't a thing. You know what I mean? It was just pull up your socks, stiff upper lip and get on with it, unless you were absolutely debilitated by it, you know what I mean? You were forced to carry on. And then I went back to the doctor and they said, well, try Effexor. But they started on me on one level, and then I ended up being on the highest possible adult dosage. I can't remember, I think it was 275 milligrams a day. It was three tablets, it was three big fucking tablets a day. Like if I didn't take them, you know, 15 minutes after I didn't take them, I'd turn my head. And you'd get this fucking, a fucking electric shock from the base of your spine right up into your brain. And it was the most horrific sensation. on top of that, then you couldn't sleep, and I was having this spatial disorientation thing where if I moved my eyes, if I looked over here quickly, my eyes still thought I was looking here, and it took,
it was like a drag.
Yeah, it was really strange. But so I went to the doctor, they stopped working. And I went to the doctor and said, look, not only have these stopped working, but they're horrific. And like, if I don't take them or forget to take them, they're horrible. I put on loads of weight. Like, they just had loads of detrimental effects on my health. And I said, I really want to come off them. And she said, no. She said, I don't think you're ready to come off them. And I said, well, can I just taper off then? And she said, no. She said, yeah, you need to stay on them. And I said, well, I don't want to. And she said, well, I'm not permitting you to. I'm not writing you a prescription for tapering off. If you want to quit them, you have to do it yourself.
Leon was left to go cold turkey on his medication. And why? Because his doctor didn't treat him as a partner in the process. And clearly, she felt she knew better, despite Leon being quite clear that this wasn't working for him. And this attitude, the attitude that dismissed Leon's concerns, this is bedded deep in the stigma that we have around mental health in Ireland.
One of the things that really annoys me is you will hear a rhetoric where people say, we need more tolerance in Ireland. We need a more tolerant society. That's a load of nonsense. I have no interest in a tolerant society in Ireland at all, because it's not what we need. Because I can tolerate Nazis, you know? I can tolerate racism. I can tolerate homophobia. I can tolerate all of these things. But that still allows it to exist. What we need is an Ireland of acceptance. We need an Ireland that has grown up enough to accept our own problems. And then if we tolerate our problem, we leave it sitting there. If we accept the problem, then we're compelled to challenge it and address it. We need a people that are accepting of difference, that we don't have to agree with it, but we have to acknowledge that difference exists, that we accept people who are different to us, with different ideologies to us, with different backgrounds to us, and with different ambitions to us. Because that's what's going to make the difference. Mm. Because it's when we don't accept people, we stigmatise people. Mm. You know, stigma comes from the ancient word of physically branding. So taking that hot iron and branding you, that's where the word stigma comes from. And that's what it is. Anytime that we sit down and generate this argument of who is us and who is them, we are creating more and more problems. And we all do it. I do it. Yeah. But the difficulty there is when you have them and us, we will always have conflict. We will always have difficulty. And we will always have crisis. We will always end up with suicide and self-harm. If we can genuinely move towards a point where there's none of them and only us, and I don't mean that in the negative way. I mean, just accept that us is a very diverse group of people. That's the difference we make. And that ties into politics. It ties into our own football clubs, our own schools, our own families, our own ideologies. We have to challenge so much of what we own and believe and hold to be true. Yeah. The vision of Pieta House is of a world where suicide, self-harm and stigma are replaced by hope, self-care and acceptance. In order to replace thoughts of suicide with thoughts of hope, and to replace actual self-harm with actual self-care, we need our therapists. And that can be done in our therapy rooms. But that final piece about having a world that has taken stigma and replaced it with acceptance, we can't do that in a therapy room. Because the people we're working with are the people who have been branded with that stigma. In order to fight stigma and get acceptance, we need to work with the people who apply the stigma. And darkness into light is the most incredible way of doing that. So we are trying to talk to 200,000 people across the world, people in Ireland, people in the Emirates, where suicide is a sin, where suicide is a crime, where we shouldn't be talking to them at all, but who are engaging with us. And that unified voice of all of the people who do darkness into light. And I'm not sure that the people who do darkness into light realise how powerful they are. I don't know how much they realise that by walking in Cahir Sabhain in May in their yellow t-shirts, there's somebody at the other side of the world in a country where it is much more stigmatised, oozing and soaking up that power, that impetus to move forward in suicide prevention and taking it upon themselves and moving forward with it.
The stigma that existed in 1985 in Ireland, both for mental health, sexuality, a variety of issues, was just, you could nearly feel and touch it. Nobody could come out and talk about their experience of depression, the individual or the family members. It was just a massive weight on everybody's shoulders. The old model might have been that if you experienced depression, you went to your GP and then you went to a psychiatrist. And, you know, going back in the old days, you were then admitted into a hospital. And I think the idea that there's appropriate therapies was broadening that out to recovery. So I think Aware's vision back then is utterly valid today. The stigma is not to the same level as it existed, 33 years ago. But it would be a mistake to say that stigma does not exist. It is still a major, major factor. And then we know from the workplace that, you know, all of the wellness programs that are going in, that, you know, nobody's going to walk into their boss and say, even today in 2018, unless they have a really good relationship, but they're not going to walk in and say, I'm experiencing depression. And you won't be saying it at your interview. And I saw a piece of research there last week about getting married. How many people will say to their potential partner at some stage they will, but in the early stages of a relationship, I'm on medication, I'm on that and that's so there's that massive stigma. Whereas if you're in an early part of a relationship, you'll say, oh, I broke my leg. You'll say, so the stigma is still with us, and we need to break down those barriers.
I think what I would like to see in our lifetimes is a Pieta House that in its crisis intervention is much smaller than it currently is. I think we will need to continue to engage and push forward and invest in resilience building, even just in encouraging conversations. To go back to the point that we were talking about earlier on in terms of the referendums, we're good at talking in Ireland. We're not bad at listening, and we're not bad at actioning. So if we can encourage everyone to stay good at talking, to get better at listening, and to be more productive at actioning, then in families, in households, you know, we can do so. Can you imagine if you're working with first-time parents who, you know, I see it in my brothers, and they have a baby and they don't know what end the nappy goes on and what end it doesn't. But can you imagine if we're talking to parents and saying, your child is going to grow up, and your child is going to grow up in this kind of environment. And in fact, in 15 years, when your child hits puberty, we can't even predict what the world's going to look like. If we gave them hints and tools about how we care for the mental health of a child, because they're told, feed them this, exercise them this way, do this, do that. We're told how to feed them. We're told how to grow them physically. But if the mental piece was built in at the earliest stage, I wouldn't need to do what I'm doing now. And that's what I think, that's where I think we need to move to. Now, is it Pieta House that should be doing that? Probably not. But that's where partnership comes in. Yeah. That's where people who do work in that space can engage in those conversations, and where we can work together to try and combat issues that we know are going to happen. Every child that is born is going to have mental health. It may be good and it may be bad, and it's probably going to be a mixture of the two. The reality is, the current housing crisis has an impact on suicide rates. The reality is that high levels of unemployment and that disconnection from the labour market and that disconnection from society, if you go back to my dartboard, any policy that removes one of those rings of support from an individual is a policy that has to be challenged. So employment, housing, education, social protection, care for children, all of these things have to be addressed, because if they are all addressed, they are components of mental health. And at the moment, I think they sit too siloed from each other. And where you have a client who comes to Pieta House who has poor academic achievement or may have a learning difficulty, who may be the victim of abuse, who is unemployed, who doesn't have a relationship, there's no kind of streamlined way of going to one point or one person to seek support, or one department to look for funding or support when they leave Pieta House. There are too many people to talk to. And I think that has to be brought together. I don't know how that is. I'm not a parliamentarian. I'm not a politician. But, you know, I think as a bare minimum, even if we narrow this down to young people and how do we address the needs of young people and the future generation, surely social protection, youth affairs, housing, education and health need to be connected.
When we asked ourselves the bigger question, which is, you know, over the long term, what would make the difference in Ireland? Wouldn't it be great if we were measuring Irish success by how well we were doing at supporting people's well-being, not just by the GDP and the unemployment figures or the surface indicators? Yeah. Yeah, I think that one of the solutions is to start measuring ourselves against other countries and asking our politicians to measure their success against how well they're improving the well-being, the mental health and well-being of everyone in Ireland.
Leon spends his time now thinking about what needs to change in the system. And he helps other people, lots and lots of other people. He says that it's part of his recovery, and it's part of what makes him feel better. I asked him what we should be doing better as a society for people who need help with their mental health.
I think that having access to free, quality therapy, subsidised, is important. I think having every single CEO and company in the country having mandatory training and on recognising mental health issues and how to treat them and how not to treat them, more importantly. Look, if you walk into work with a crutch or with a plaster on, or, you know, with a sprained wrist or a black eye or a broken nose or whatever, they're going to say, Jesus, what happened to you? And you're going to get sympathy. You know, you're going to go, they're going to go to the doctor, do whatever you need. If you go in with the sniffles, they're going to tell you to go home. But if you go in absolutely devastated in the throes of a depressive episode or worse, it's not obvious. You know, you get up that day and you put on your skin suit and you go out to work and you put on your plastic smile and you get on with it. Because we've been told to. We've been conditioned to do that because there's no other option. I think it's easy to recognise when someone is having issues, even if they're wearing that happy suit. You know what I mean? You can kind of tell after a while. Especially if you've got everybody that has experience with it or is in any way empathic can tell. Even people that can't, that aren't, can tell. But those that can't can be taught how to. It's not hard. It's just listening and watching and noticing and being a bit more, treat people with a bit more respect, I think, and a bit gentler. You know, this whole attitude of pull up your socks and get on with it is bullshit, because eventually those fucking socks end up getting pulled up too long and they could end up strangling you. You know what I mean? There is no pull it up, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's absolute crap. Getting workplaces involved in recognising and training up all members of staff in how to recognise mental health issues and how to approach them. Having access to therapy that actually means something and that matters and that is personal and one-on-one and has an impact at your own time, maybe weekends as well as outside of work hours as well. You know, that 24-hour access to someone is a genius idea. Now, having the problems we have in this country with everything else, I mean, the resources just probably aren't there to do it, but I cope by helping other people or trying to help other people for a long time after that. And that's when I started going into talking about it openly and online and a lot. And from doing that, weird, you know, if I didn't intend this to happen, but from just being open and talking about it and putting a post about it when I was depressed and letting people know online what was happening, and putting a name on it, I used to call it, and I still do, the Black Waves, people used to contact me privately most of the time, and send me messages in confidence and saying that they had problems as well. And it was over the course of about a year that I started to connect with all of these people, just because they didn't want to talk about it publicly, or they'd been stigmatised, or they weren't as open about it, and that's completely up to them. But they'd seen me post about it, and then they got in touch with me and said, can I talk to you about it? And then that opened up a whole new world to me of discussing this with people. Now, if I could heed my own advice, I'd be fucking cured. I feel like I have helped a good few people. I probably haven't helped a good few people more, but like I feel like I definitely have helped a good few people. And I've met a lot of my friends, a lot of close friends because of that. And a lot of other friends have become closer because of it too. And that was a big help for me. It was sort of therapy. As thankful as people were and are, it's definitely a symbiotic relationship. I get as much for myself from helping people or attempting to help friends and even people I don't know. One of the big stigmas with mental illness is that there's a lot of people who can deal with mental illness themselves, or who can swallow hard or pretend that they're doing okay, or can, as I said, wake up in the morning, put on their skin suit and go out and pretend that they're not dying inside. There's a lot of people who can't, and they turn to drink or drugs to medicate themselves. And I found that there was so many people around me that I had absolutely no idea, and people that I was close to and still am close to, that had, in my opinion, worse problems than me.
And did you think they had their shit together?
And I totally thought they had their shit together. I thought they were the coolest people in the world. Maybe they were the coolest people in the world because of this. I don't know. I mean, it does have an edge to it, you know what I mean, sometimes. But I wouldn't change a bit of it, though, because I don't think I'd be who I am. Now, I don't know the other person who I'd be, but I feel like I'm very empathic, and that's because I know what it's like to suffer. And I know what it feels like, and I know what it feels like when someone's there for you to help.
And it seems to me as though we all need to be a bit more like Leon, to be active supports for other people who are in our rings of support, to consciously create the kind of world that we all want to live in.
You know, I always think Irish society needs every single person who's able to make a difference to be there ready to do their thing, whatever that thing is. And the idea that we would turn away anybody from help, that would get them back to being able to be part of what makes Ireland great, you know, is really silly and tragic. Silly and tragic.
Pieta House will be here in 5-10 years. But when you look at any minister in government, they won't always be in government for a start, or certainly they won't always be the minister. So one of the difficulties we'll always face is suicide. It's as old as time itself, and it will be here. Our job is to try and stop it, try and reduce it. A permanent problem needs a much more permanent type of solution. We politicise issues, and politics changes, and then the issue gets lost. But there are certain things, like the health of our people and the mental health of our people, that will always need to be supported and cared for. We're a pack animal, in the best sense of the word.
So to quote Spike Milligan again, everybody has to be somewhere. We are all located in families, in friendships, in work relationships, in communities, and in tribes. And we can all have a profound impact on them by challenging stigma and promoting acceptance, and by working together to prioritise things that will help us all live well, be well, and if and when any of us hit a stormy time when we need extra help, that it's not just the system that provides support, it's everyone around us, it's our whole world. We create our institutions, we vote for our political representatives, and together we can create a change in how we view, treat, and indeed understand mental health. In the next episode, we're going to turn to children. We know that our mental health services for our children are at an all-time crisis point. More children are presenting with mental health needs and issues at younger and younger ages. But there is an opportunity here, an opportunity to start the work of mental health care at the earliest possible stage in life. And this opportunity has the potential to create a light of hope for our future generations. Next week on Where There's a Will.
Thanks for listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review us on iTunes, or just tell a friend about us. Also, we want to hear from you. Have you had experiences with the system, good or bad, that you'd like to share? Or have you ideas on how we can make things better, easier and faster for people to get help? Send us a short voice recording to editor@alustforlife.com, or just record a WhatsApp voice note and text it to 083-119-0269. That's 083-119-0269.
And just as a reminder, if you have been affected by any of the issues raised by this podcast, there is help available. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. If you just need to talk, you can also contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP. Check out alustforlife.com for contact information for all of the support available.
Where There's a Will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.